30 years ago this week, on April 5th, 1994, Kurt Cobain, the Nirvana frontman whose raw, angst-ridden lyrics made him the voice of Gen X and a seminal figure in alternative rock history, walked up the stairs of his home in the Lake Washington neighborhood of Seattle and into a greenhouse constructed over the first floor garage. Cobain entered a closet at the far end of the greenhouse, dislodged a board from the wall to reveal a cubby nobody else knew was there, and removed three items: a Remington Model 11 20-gauge shotgun, a box of shotgun shells, and a cigar box containing $50 worth of black tar heroin and a syringe. Cobain sat down at a small table and wrote a one-page suicide note in red ink, which he addressed to Bodah, B-O-D-D-A-H, a name that 20-plus years ago he'd given to an imaginary childhood friend. According to Cobain's biographers, Bodah had long been a figure of refuge for Cobain, through his difficult childhood and the slow disintegration of his relationship with Courtney Love, and he now turned back to it one last time. Cobain had a long history of depression brought on, or at least exacerbated by, chronic health issues and substance abuse problems, which were well documented throughout his life. But over the past few months, he had slipped into a malaise that consumed him. Courtney had left him and taken their two-year-old daughter, Frances Bean, after he couldn't or wouldn't comply with a series of ultimatums she'd given him to try to get clean. And friends were giving up hope. On March 4, 1994, Cobain was hospitalized in Rome after taking 50 Rohypnol pills. His management team tried to spin it as an accidental overdose, but Courtney knew better, confirming it had been a suicide attempt. When he was released from the hospital and returned home in late March, Love, along with several of Kurt's friends and Nirvana bandmates, staged an intervention at Cobain's home, during which they collectively gave him one final ultimatum: seek treatment or lose his wife, his child, and his band forever. Cobain tried his best to do what they asked, and on March 30th, he flew to Los Angeles and checked himself into the Exodus Recovery Center, a drug rehab facility experienced in working with high-profile celebrities. 2 days later, however, Cobain told the facility staff he was going onto the balcony to smoke a cigarette, but instead scaled a 6-foot rock wall and disappeared. That same day, he left a cryptic voicemail message for Courtney saying, quote, "Just remember, no matter what, I love you." He eventually made his way to the airport and flew back to Seattle on April 2nd. Cobain's whereabouts over the next few days are largely unknown. He apparently did not see or call anyone he knew, including his wife and daughter. Neighbors claimed to have spotted an ill-looking Cobain in a park near his house, but that was never confirmed. Cobain's closest friend, Mark Lanegan, began to fear the worst, saying, quote, "Kurt hadn't called me. He hadn't called his family. He hadn't called anybody. I had a feeling that something real bad had happened." And he was right. On April 5th, in the greenhouse, Kurt Cobain injected himself with the heroin he'd kept in the cigar box in the secret cubby in the wall and completed his suicide note. He then loaded the shells into the shotgun, put the barrel into his mouth, and pulled the trigger. Kurt Cobain was 27 years old. I'm Jason Beckerman.
I'm Derek Kaufman.
This is Last Days, Kurt Cobain.
From one perspective, Kurt Cobain's death, however tragic, was unremarkable. Another rich and successful young musician succumbing to the excesses of drugs and alcohol until it ultimately killed him. It was the same with Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, Alan Wilson, Jim Morrison from The Doors, and Amy Winehouse, each of whom, like Cobain, died at age 27 and at the height of their respective careers. Cobain's mother, Wendy, speaking on this horrible coincidence, noted with sadness that her son had, quote, "gone and joined that stupid club." But to relegate Cobain to a statistic does a disservice to what he achieved. In just 2.5 years, from the release of Nevermind in September 1991 through his death in April 1994, Cobain, as Nirvana's lead singer and principal songwriter, transformed American rock music. Nevermind challenged the dominance of the hair metal and pop music of the time and rushed forward a new era of alternative rock that paved the way for the widespread popularity of grunge music, which had up until then been an underground music movement unique to the Pacific Northwest. Nirvana didn't invent the genre, but more than any band before it, it successfully fused punk, metal, and alt-rock with subtle pop influences to create music that was loved equally by grunge fans and more mainstream pop audiences alike. Nevermind became so mainstream, in fact, that it displaced Michael Jackson's Dangerous at the top of the Billboard charts and for a brief period crowned Nirvana as arguably the biggest and most popular band in the world. Each of Nevermind's 13 tracks, all written and sung by Cobain, tapped into the angst and worry of a generation and spoke to their feelings of frustration and alienation. The album's first single, Smells Like Teen Spirit, nicknamed the anthem for apathetic kids, instantly propelled Nirvana to global stardom with its distorted guitar sound and gritty, hyper-realistic lyrics. The song's unbridled energy combined with Cobain's iconic vocals captured the disaffected spirit of Gen X like nothing before or since. Nirvana toured Europe at the end of 1991 and played shows that were described by critics as, quote, dangerously oversold, with hordes of fans and reporters following the band wherever it went. In addition to Smells Like Teen Spirit, three more Nevermind songs became hit singles, Come As You Are, Lithium, and In Bloom. The band's songs were almost omnipresent on radio and music television, and the album was selling an average of 300,000 copies per week. And to date, Nevermind has sold nearly 30 million copies, making it one of the most successful albums of all time.
It's hard to overstate for anybody who wasn't there at the time how big Nirvana was. And it's not just that they were big, it's that they came out of nowhere. Because outside of the Seattle underground clubs, nobody had ever heard of them. Nobody had heard of Kurt Cobain. And their music was unlike anything anybody had ever heard. It's not like Taylor Swift coming along with pop music. Granted, she does it maybe better than anybody.
Yeah.
But it's a type of music we'd heard before. And all of a sudden, to a mainstream pop-loving crew, all of a sudden comes this hard-edged, raspy, alt-rock group that takes over.
It doesn't seem like it could be mainstream. They're mumbling. They're wearing dirty outfits. This was the height of hair metal, right?
Yes.
And that is the ultimate in excess.
Right.
And what Nirvana did and the rest of the grunge scene is they truly just force that out of the limelight. You know, it's not like when disco ended and the next brand of music came out to fill a void because everyone was sick of disco. People liked hair metal. It was very, very
Poison
popular.
Poison was bigger than ever.
That's right. Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses was huge. But then you get into 91, 92, and Nirvana just takes over. And I don't think we've ever seen that from a genre of music that was just different than anything we had heard before.
Yes.
Again,
it was a tidal wave that crashed over the careers of, as you said, Poison, Guns N' Roses, all those bands that were massive. They just couldn't compete. And Michael Jackson, that statistic about what it did to Dangerous, I know this was post-Thriller and post-Bad, but Michael Jackson's still Michael Jackson.
He was still the biggest artist in the world, number one.
And Nirvana just elbowed it right aside.
Very short period of time, obviously, as we talk about. But nevertheless, it's incredible who they were for that period of time. And there are other grunge bands, obviously Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, some others that became huge. But nothing, I don't think that in my lifetime has ever compared to what Nirvana pulled off at that moment.
They were the Beatles of grunge.
That's right.
There were other bands. There were Rolling Stones. Yeah. There were the Animals. But they were the Beatles of that movement.
But just as the band was taking off, Kurt Cobain was descending. In the late 1980s, he was diagnosed with chronic gastritis, an inflammation of the stomach lining that causes extreme pain and nausea. He would later write that during the 1991 tour for Nevermind, he began to use heroin in order to cope with the pain, and he contemplated suicide for the first time. The heroin helped. Opioids in all forms are great painkillers. But months of use, interrupted by only very brief stints of sobriety, began to affect his physical health and his psyche. Cobain had since childhood suffered bouts of depression. He said he'd been melancholic since his parents divorced when he was just 9 years old, and his ongoing battle with heroin made it worse. Heroin, like many opioids, can be a very effective short-term treatment for depression. Indeed, ketamine infusion therapies, as we talked about in the context of Matthew Perry, are today among the most common and effective means of treating depression. But when Cobain would try to wean himself away from the addiction, the withdrawal symptoms and the abdominal pain would fuel an unmanageable resurgence of depression and abuse. He talked at length. He had a lot of suicidal ideation. He assigned it all to the pain. He assigned all of his problems to his stomach pain. The reason he took heroin in the first place, he says, was because of the stomach pain. The reason that he wanted to kill himself was not because of the addiction. It was because of the stomach pain. And initially, there were a lot of doubters out there who challenged him on that, who said he just wasn't tough, or he was always a little bit removed, who said that it was just basically a fear of crowds, of fame, et cetera. And he acknowledged that he had some dislike for that as well, some distaste for the success and the fame. But ultimately for him, it all came back to the crippling stomach pain.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, and Walmart, and even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. So download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. R-A-K-U-T-E-N.
So as Nirvana is peaking in popularity in the midst of this frenzy, Cobain marries Courtney Love in February 1992. The two had begun dating the previous year when Nirvana was at the peak and Cobain was grappling with physical pain and depression. Multiple sources suggest that it was Love who introduced Cobain to heroin, something that she has never admitted and in fact denies. But whatever that truth, it is unquestionably also the case that it was Love who pushed him hardest to get clean for the sake of their unborn child. And in July of that year, during a break from touring, Cobain, at Love's insistence, enrolled in an intensive detox program at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. The next month, Frances Bean was born at the same hospital, which allowed Cobain to be present at her birth. He shortly thereafter concluded the rehab stint, and the family of three moved into an LA apartment together. But a month later, Vanity Fair published an article alleging drug use by Love during her pregnancy with Frances, which led to a subsequent investigation by child welfare authorities and ultimately the temporary removal of the child from the parents' custody. Love, who has vehemently denied the allegations of drug use during her pregnancy, nevertheless checked herself into rehab as a condition of getting her daughter back. That stint apparently did Love well, and by all indications she remained sober for some time, but Kurt was not so fortunate. Within weeks of leaving rehab and having his child taken from him, Cobain relapsed, and the cycle of addiction restarted again.
Courtney Love is a complicated figure, Jason. I mean, in one sense, she was very much part of this same scene that Kurt Cobain was in, where there was just a lot of drug use. I mean, the grunge scene and heroin go hand in hand, and she was the founder of the band Hole. She was part of that scene as well. But I do believe she was not quite the same level of sensitivity. You know, Cobain really was angst-ridden and wore all of his emotions on his sleeve, and it seems as though Love was able to sort of harness her life a little bit, and she had the kid, and she would go through these sort of bouts of pulling things together a little bit and getting her life in order. She was a movie star for a period of time. Cobain never really had that ability to manage the success.
I would say maybe it's unfair to Courtney Love. Cobain is a genius in the very like Van Gogh sense of the word genius. One of the great geniuses I think we've ever had as an American in the 21st century. A tortured artist soul. And to your point about sensitivity, his art was everything. He often talked about he didn't want the money. He didn't want the fame. He wanted to make art that he wanted to listen to. And he would never betray himself like that by putting out art that he didn't think was good.
It was very authentic.
Courtney Love was more commercial. I mean, not that her music was necessarily more commercial, but she was more commercial. I don't think this is a knock on her. No. She was just somebody that went out there. She wanted to make a lot of money. She wanted to party hard. She wanted to do a ton of drugs. And that filled her life up. But for him, it was pain. It was depression. That's what led to the drug use. But he just wanted to be an artist, and he was a tortured artist at that.
I think that's right. But as the saying goes, great pain is the birth spring of great art. And in the late summer of 1992, Cobain began compiling songs that would become the album In Utero. The album was released the following September, and although Cobain claimed it was, quote, very impersonal, many of its songs, such as Heart-Shaped Box, about the codependency inherent in relationships, and Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle, about a woman vilified for suffering from mental health issues, are clear allusions to Cobain's and Love's personal struggles. But Cobain wrote the album's biggest hit and perhaps its greatest song, All Apologies, 3 years earlier, and it reflects his more upbeat mental state at the time. Cobain explained to his biographer, Michael Azarad, that the song is not about any particular facet of his life, but unlike the later written songs on the album, its mood is, quote, peaceful and happy. What else should I be? In Utero was, like its predecessor Nevermind, an unqualified commercial and critical success, reaching number one on both the US and UK charts. But the album's success was not a salve for Cobain's addiction and depression, and between its release in September 1993 and his death 6 months later, it's believed that he used heroin nearly every single day. Despite Cobain's difficulties, Nirvana continued to perform, although his bandmates, Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl, were well aware of how sick he was and the toll it was taking on them all. Years later, Novoselic told Rolling Stone that Kurt made the last year with Nirvana nearly intolerable, and he and Grohl talked openly about going their separate ways. He said, quote, "It was tough being around Kurt because he was a very intense person. He was in a lot of pain, he had a lot of health issues, and he had this substance abuse problem, and it just made everything so much harder for him and for all of us." Nevertheless, the band continued on with the gravitational tug of Cobain's sheer brilliance keeping them together. And that brilliance was perhaps never on fuller display than on November 18th, 1993, at an intimate gathering in New York for MTV Unplugged.
So this concert, the MTV Unplugged concert, is the ultimate testament to Cobain's brilliance. They sit down for 55 minutes, and you can watch it on YouTube or anywhere else you want to watch it.
He's in the trademark sweater. I mean, it's iconic. People dress up as Halloween as Kurt Cobain on MTV Unplugged.
That's right. He's using his iconic guitar that became the subject of a later lawsuit that you and I have talked about previously. And he, for 55 minutes, plays. Everybody knows that he's a brilliant lyricist, a great guitar player. What people didn't know, I think, until this moment was what a sublime singer he was, what an incredible voice he has.
Even thinking about it, I've got goosebumps, because it's one of those moments in music history in our lifetime. We've all heard about the Beatles going on Ed Sullivan. There are big music moments with Elvis and so forth, yes. But we lived this. I remember this coming on, and his music was so noisy. He sort of smells like Teen Spirit. You had that video. You could barely understand the lyrics. And when he stripped it all down to just singing, and he was truly a poet, you could hear the lyrics crisply. And it was incredible how grunge music translated into an acoustic set. I never would have fathomed it. And you just can't forget it. It's one of those performances. You should Google it. It's incredible.
And there's no clearer example, I think, than the rendition of Bowie's The Man Who Sold the World that Cobain sang that night.
We passed upon the stairs. Spoken wasn't well, although I wasn't there. Said I was his friend, which came as a surprise. I spoke into his eyes, I thought you died.
Derek, you and I have talked about this before. That is when Bowie wrote it as a little kid, that was my favorite song, The Man Who Sold the World by David Bowie. And when Cobain did it, that version is objectively better.
He took it. He covered it, and he took the song from David Bowie, no less. David Bowie is pretty famous.
Think about it from my perspective. This is my favorite song. All of a sudden, this new upstart is singing my favorite artist's favorite song, and you have to admit, you got to give him the credit.
He owns it. It's like Aretha Franklin taking respect from Otis Redding.
Right.
She just did it, and Otis Redding eventually said, that's her song.
And Bowie, by the way, loved it, talks about that, says it was better than his version. It's just unquestionably a brilliant song, and his performance of it that night, for one night only, will live in music lore, I think, for as long as there is such a thing as music lore.
Without a doubt.
Coming out of the Unplugged recording session, Cobain said he wanted to lean into the, quote, ethereal acoustic sound for Nirvana's next album. After his death, his close friend, R.E.M. frontman Michael Stipe, said about Kurt, quote, "Yeah, he talked a lot about what direction he was heading in. The next album was going to be very quiet and acoustic, with lots of stringed instruments. It was going to be an amazing fucking record, and I'm a little bit angry at him for killing himself. He and I were going to record a trial run of the album, a demo tape. It was all set up. He had a plane ticket. He had a car picking him up. And at the last minute, he called and said, I can't come." We'd like to talk about counterfactuals, what would have happened if somebody hadn't passed away. I think Michael Stipe is setting that up. He was just going to continue the musical brilliance, going in a slightly different direction he'd been before, but continue to make great music.
I mean, he was 27 years old, so he was truly entering the prime of most people's careers in music when they really hit their stride and they sort of, you know, shake off some of the youthful exuberance and become true artists. And it's an absolute pity. We'll never see that from Kurt Cobain, because he was truly a poet, but we just have his early music.
Yeah.
That's all we'll ever have.
And as confident as Stipe was that he would release this, they would record together this acoustic album, it's really impossible to know. He so easily vacillated between wanting to make new music or quit music altogether and go on his own, or leave it all behind and join an ashram. And actually, the ashram thing, it was a real thing for Cobain. He developed an acute aversion to people and to his own celebrity. There's this interview he did. It's a really weird scene. He's just standing on the side of a dock in Seattle. There's a lot of noise around. It's almost like it's a woman interviewing him. You don't see her, but she sounds very young. I almost feel like like a young student saw with her phone, saw Kurt Cobain standing there and said, "Oh my God, it's Kurt Cobain." And he sort of agreed to answer some questions for her. And the first question she asks him is, "Are you reading any good books recently? Is there any book that inspires you?" Which is such like a, you know, a non-professional reporter's question, but it solicited from him or elicited from him an answer that was really incredible. He says, he describes the protagonist in this book called Perfume, which I had never heard of. And this is what he has to say about him.
He's just disgusted basically with all humans, and he just can't get away from humans. So he goes on this trek, this walk of death, where he goes into the rural areas where there's, you know, woods all over the place and the small villages, and he only travels by night. And he just, every time he smells human, like a fire from a far off way, you know, he'll just get really disgusted and hide, and he just tries to stay away from people. I kind of relate to that.
It's eerie. It's beyond eerie and prophetic to hear him talk about just how uncomfortable he was with people. You know, frankly, and when you're as successful as him, it was like Beatlemania. Yeah. So anyone who could spot him, even this person who's interviewing him, as you said, may have just spotted him. And that was his entire existence. He was on display and truly uncomfortable with being on display.
Taking that guy who just wants to be in the wilderness by himself and never see another human being, it's hard to imagine the Michael Stipe fantasy. It's hard to imagine him coming back and going back out on tour again and doing all that stuff. I mean, the addiction, the stomach pain, all of that mixed with his real sort of dislike of people and anxieties, it's hard to believe that he ever really comes back from it.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine that Cobain was destined to be anything other than what he was, which is a very tragic figure. In the days after his disappearance from the Los Angeles Rehab Center on April 2nd, Courtney Love hired a private investigator to find her husband, while Cobain's mother issued a missing persons report. And authorities searched the home, but apparently nobody thought to look inside his garage or the greenhouse above it. And finally, on April 8th, 3 days after the coroner concluded Cobain died, an electrician who was doing work on the house forced his way into the greenhouse and discovered Kurt's body. The existence of the suicide note Jason talked about at the top wasn't disclosed by authorities for some time after Cobain's body was found, and it's been the subject of controversy ever since. Some sources say it was found in a planter in the greenhouse, impaled through its center with the same pen Cobain used to write it, while others say it was found folded up in his wallet. Conspiracy theorists insist it's a fake, planted by Love to cover up her own direct involvement in his death, pointing to the fact that several sentences were crossed out and the handwriting grows irregular and erratic in the second half of the letter. This is easily explained by the fact that the heroin Cobain had injected was slowly taking effect and making it harder for him to keep a steady hand. But those who want to blame Courtney Love for his death see what they want to see in every detail. But at the end of the day, there's just no evidence to suggest that the facts of what happened are any different than the official story of unassisted suicide.
Cobain's suicide note is heartfelt and sentimental. It is painful to read, especially in the context of knowing how much pain he was in and the trauma his death caused to his friends and bandmates, and most of all, his daughter Frances, who has talked about the enduring sadness she feels at never knowing her father. During his life, Kurt Cobain was praised as a lyricist because of his raw honesty, introspection, and emotional depth, and for his ability to capture complex feelings in his words. It was no different as he prepared for his death. His suicide note is itself brilliant, addressed to Boda, but laden with thanks and love to his bandmates. But his final words were reserved for his wife and daughter, to whom he wrote, "Frances and Courtney, I'll be at your altar. Please keep going, Courtney, for Frances, for her life, which will be so much happier without me. I love you. I love you." He then concluded, "I don't have the passion anymore. So remember, it's better to burn out than fade away. Peace, love, empathy. Kurt Cobain."